Ladies and gentlemen, this is the 12th and final round.
Right hand, Golovkin steps in and down he goes again. Unbelievable! Mayweather makes him pay. What a rookie mistake. A sensational left hook by De La Hoya.
It's facts. I'm the best. You know what I mean? Sometimes I don't want to believe it myself, but it's the truth. I'm the best.
I'm going to show you how great I am.
From Southern California, this is the Last Round Podcast.
Welcome to episode 158 of the Last Round Podcast. And joining me today for, I think, the fourth time, we have Patrick Connor. Thanks for joining me, Patrick.
Yeah, thanks for having me back. I really appreciate it, Michael.
Are you ready for the holidays? Are you ready for Christmas and New Year?
Yeah, you know, I think that like most people, I'm ready for like a new year, but also kind of hesitant to see what exactly is going on and what 2022 is going to bring. But I'm also ready for a change, you know, ready for that yearly change. How are you, man?
Hopefully the 2022 is the end of COVID and the end of Omicron and whatever else virus is going to be coming around.
For multiple reasons, including getting back to some slightly more normal boxing.
Exactly. Well, jumping straight in to the fight reviews. Friday the 17th of December from the Bell Centre, Montreal, Quebec, Canada. Artur Beterbiev moved to 17-0, 17 KOs, with a ninth round KO over Marcus Brown. This was for the WBC and IBF light heavyweight titles. What did you think, Patrick? What do you think of Beterbiev's performance?
He looked like he normally does. He looked very sharp. And he looked like he started kind of slow, and he looked, I think that's kind of a bit of a signature for Artur Beterbiev, just his style. He seems to, I'm not going to use all of the downloading data, all the analogies that they're using these days, but he definitely seems to take his time and work his way into analyzing an opponent and seeing what they're going to do and what they're going to bring. And Marcus Brown in some of those rounds almost seemed to overperform and made the fight interesting. But Beterbiev is just a very tactical guy and also just so precise. And he hits hard enough that with that precision, it's a massive deterrent. So the frustration with him is this, just the inactivity and the fact that there seems to have been the idea of aiming Beterbiev. Like, I mean, he's been around long enough that we were talking about matching him with Kovalev because of their amateur history several years ago. Kovalev's kind of been out of the picture for the most part for a few years now. Mm-hmm. I mean, not totally out of the picture, but he hasn't been a star for a while. So that's how long Beterbiev's kind of been hanging in there. In a way, that's his longevity and his, you know, toughness and all that type of stuff. But the inactivity also plays a role. So that's really the only knock. Otherwise, in the ring, he's a monster.
Do you put it more down to a stylistic of just starting slow? Because listen to some other, you know, boxing journalists, they were saying that he's getting old. They thought his performance against Adam, forgive me if I pronounce it wrong, is it Diaz? And then Marcus Brown. Some people were saying they think he's looking a little bit old. But you all think it's more of a stylistic type of thing?
I do think it's at least partially stylistic, but he is getting older. And whereas, you know, people talk about the amateur experience, that doesn't happen in a vacuum. Damage is accrued over time, you know, and so those kinds of things slow an athlete down, slow a fighter down over time. But there's also the flip side of it is that he's potentially a little bit fresher, not having gone through a bunch of fights. But it's a big change going from, you know, having hundreds of amateur fights and then just fighting once a year. That's a pretty big change in and of itself. And getting into his late 30s now without having really a signature win, it's kind of a little bit of a problem. So I think that kind of factors in too. He is getting older. It is stylistic. It's a mixture of these things, and really we're not going to know until he's in with an opponent who's like really going to push him, who's really going to stylistically get in his face and make him fight and not try to box with him and try to, you know, play that twitch game with him, because that shit ain't going to work. So we need somebody who's going to push him and who's going to push the pace, and that's really the only way to find out.
Who do you see is next down the line for him? Because you know, if he's looking to unify another title or become undisputed, Joe Smith Jr. is busy with Callum Johnson after Ramirez's win on the weekend. Everyone says it looks like he'll be facing Bivol. They're kind of all on a similar timeline, you know, not many weeks apart. Do you think all roads lead to Canelo?
I think that that is the kind of fight where we would find out. So it sounds like Canelo and the idea of moving to cruiserweight, I don't know if it was a PR thing or what. It might have just been a PR thing for temporarily getting his name out there, because it sounds like Ilunga Makabu and, you know, Tabiso Michuno, they're kind of busy on their own thing based on what the sanctioning bodies want to do. So Canelo is going to have to wait for the winner of that anyway. So the idea of Canelo fighting Beterbiev is kind of like, you find out how serious they are about wanting challenges. Like, are they looking for belts, and are they looking now to kind of cruise a little bit? And don't get me wrong, because I'm not going to criticize that. Canelo, even at a fairly young age, has accomplished a lot. And if he wanted to just cruise the rest of a career, I mean, so what? I'm not going to have much of a problem with that. But if the rhetoric is that he wants the best available, always wants the best, you know, is going to do this and that, then I think that taking on Artur Beterbiev would be a really big, you know, that would be a really big step in that direction without question.
How would you see that fight going if we get to see that sometime next year?
Whew. Well, I think that given the size differential, at least just height wise and in terms of the range, Canelo would be one of those kinds of fighters that would try to push the pace and try to take the fight inside, because that would obviously be his best, you know, his best chance to try to bring the fight to Beterbiev, at least intelligently. So I think that there's a really good chance that you could see Canelo as a good foil for that style. But there's also the chance that Beterbiev's just too big and too good, you know, the combination of those two things. Whereas Kovalev, you know, was at the right time of his career, potentially, you know, blah, blah, blah. There's asterisk on some of these recent Canelo opponents. But I mean, he can only fight them when he fights them. He can't fight them, you know, at some imaginary prime or something like that. So I think that it would be a really fun fight, a good fight to try to predict, a difficult fight to predict. And again, the kind of fight where we would be sent a clear message that, yeah, he's looking to take on the best.
Do you think a win against somebody like Beterbiev would prove how good Canelo is? Because I think even now he still has a few detractors.
And that's kind of what I mean about the asterisks. Some of them are a little bit fair. Some of them are a little bit unfair. Like, just for a quick example, like going down Caleb Plant, a lot of people might say, well, Caleb Plant didn't have a signature win. He didn't really have any world-class wins, you know, and so he was relatively unproven, and then he was picked apart. Okay, you know, I'm not really going to argue with that. And then Billy Joe Saunders, et cetera, and there's kind of similar criticisms for these recent opponents. But again, he's not only fighting them when he can fight them. He can't change the time he can fight them, really, but also he's like crushing them. He's not like being given a hard time by most of these fighters. He's beating them down brutally. And so he's just running through this list of fighters that it might not be a murderer's row, but it's nothing to sneeze at. Like, these are top contenders. Just because he was born into an era where the top contenders don't hold a torch to, like, you know, the golden era of X, Y, or Z, that's not his fault. And that's, you know, that's every other fighter who wasn't in that era. So it doesn't count against him, I don't think. But yeah, there are going to be detractors. And he said, I think today or yesterday, haters are always going to hate, you know, the old cliche or whatever. But it is true to some degree. He's not going to be able to please everyone or make everyone happy, despite the fact that he had a hell of a late 2020 and all of 2021, man. It was a hell of a run. If I think anybody's really sitting down and criticizing what Canelo's doing in the last year or two, they're just sour pusses, dude.
We're human, Patrick. We just like to moan.
I am among us. I like to bitch and moan myself, but
never happier. Never happier.
Even me, I've been shut up by Canelo for the most part, you know.
Moving on to another fight that weekend from Tashkent, Uzbekistan on DAZN. Israel Madrimov moved to 8-0 with a TKO 9 over Michel Soro. Very strange end to this fight, and that's something I think we're going to beat like a dead horse over this episode. So people who didn't see it, the bell went, and the referee, I'm assuming, didn't hear it. And Madrimov had Michel Soro against the ropes and unleashed 7-8 punches, and then the referee jumped in and stopped it. What was your take on that, Patrick? I think, in fairness to the referee, even watching the replay several times, the bell wasn't that loud.
Yeah, it seemed like in a couple of rounds there was a little bit of an issue with the timing on hearing the bell. And also, I mean, I'm not trying to make excuses, honestly, because I don't know anybody in the situation. I don't care. I don't have any horse here, whatever. But it did seem like it was a big event, almost like an event, like to the point where they might not have been quite ready for that attention or something, because there were a lot of local celebrities there. There were a lot of people there that were, you know, hanging out and stuff like that. It seemed to be a pretty big deal. And the crowd was pretty rowdy. At least it seemed rowdy to me. So yeah, I could totally see how the ref could have a difficult time in that situation, hearing the bell or officiating that fight or something. But I mean, it was kind of blatant, and it was to the point where like the bell rang and he got off like 6, 7, 8 shots, something like that. Like pretty bad too. And almost to the point where it was a bad stoppage because he took those shots, whether the bell rang or not. So there's a couple different criticisms there, unfortunately. The right thing probably to do would have been to give him time to recover and see what happens. And if he can't recover, like call it a no contest or something, I don't know. But that's kind of the funny thing about boxing, is that a lot of snap decisions get made in the moment. And it's like the prevailing consensus, and at least for now, until something changes, is that whatever the call is in the moment generally stands.
Probably because there's a lot more boxing televised lately, but it seems to be coming, you know, to the forefront of how many mistakes. So a week or 2 weeks ago, we had that fight between Bradley Ski and Shiraz, where obviously, you know, Bradley Ski was down, Shiraz hits him 2 or 3 times, you know, Ski goes to the floor, referee pretty much drags him back to his feet, pretty much makes him return to the fight. Do you think that we just need better training? Do we need to stop making it kind of like a job for the boys, where we, you know, are breeding through maybe some younger referees who are a little bit more on point? Or do you think it's sometimes, obviously not that fight, but the Uzbekistan fight, or is it just sometimes where they go to new markets and the referees aren't used to this big of a fight?
I think that it's actually a little bit of all of those things, because boxing's always been around, and there have always been mistakes and officiating mistakes and weird judging and refereeing and whatnot. That's almost like a hallmark of combat sports and boxing. But now we're getting to see it. We're getting to see it live. All sorts of apps and other streaming services we're seeing them in real time. And so these referees that are sometimes in locales that, not to trash the locales at all, but many of these kind of more far-flung locales have much smaller athletic commissions, fewer people who are available, far less experience, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so seeing them be put on the spot is almost like watching somebody grow up on TV or something. You know, it's awkward, and they make a lot of mistakes. And so when that winds up happening, we see it a lot more rather than having to read about it a month or two later in the ring or whatever. So, you know, we get to see it ourselves. So that's a bit of a problem. But also, I think that it is a systemic problem, like you say, where we're seeing a lot of the same referees, we're seeing a lot of the same officials, same judges. And part of that is a financial problem, because a lot of fans and pundits will say, oh, man, well, we just need more judges, more referees. And it's really not that simple, because these are like allocated funds from the state. Like, this is not I don't want to get too much into like the economics of it, but this is not just somebody comes up with a couple hundred bucks and pays an official. It doesn't work that way. They're trained by whatever state athletic commission they work in. And the state athletic commissions, by and large, have been stripped of money throughout the years. They haven't been given more money and bigger budgets. So how do they pay more officials? For instance, real quickly, in Oregon, right across the river from where I am, they have like a really small handful of people to the point where you can't have two combat sports on the same day, like two different events, because they don't have enough officials, period. Like, not a joke, not trying to make funny. They just don't have them. So that's a bit of a problem there too, is financially getting new people in there is an issue. However, that really does seem to be one of the solutions to this issue.
Do you think they should go more down? I think I'm right in saying, because I do follow the UFC, that they kind of take most of their big referees to the event with them. And you'll get, you know, the local referees will do like the undercards, but then your big time referees, for example, Jack Reese, everyone knows Jack Reese, he would do the more main events. Do you think that would be a good idea? So we don't see, you know, because making a mistake in a fight, it costs a lot of money to the guy that loses. His paycheck could go from $50,000 down to $16,000 for his next fight.
Well, and also now another element that's coming in the last few years is legalized sports gambling.
Yeah.
So like that's a whole nother stream of, you know, financial stream that is affected by how a fight is officiated too. So I mean, it's bringing in a whole nother element, but they kind of do in the bigger states what you're talking about, primarily New York, Nevada, you know, to a lesser degree New Jersey and Florida, but California, they do have bigger name or whatever referees that they depend on to do a lot of the bigger events, but then have the kind of lesser known referees officiate the undercard and stuff like that. But yeah, those are the bigger states where they have more officials and stuff. The smaller states, it's really tougher to get away with. I mean, we just had that snafu also on that card the other day where I can't remember which fighter it was, but he didn't even know that it wasn't a 12-round fight. It was a 10-round fight instead of a 12-round fight. And they, after 10 rounds, he thinks they're still going. Like, it just happened like a week ago. I can't remember
the Probellum card.
What's that?
It was on the Probellum card, right?
Yeah, it was. Yeah. And I was just like, oh my God. How gutting to that fighter. But in any case, that's the kind of thing that shouldn't happen, you know? And so unfortunately, these kinds of things happen way more than they should.
What do you think of, I know that Las Vegas used it and they still messed it up. The video, looking back at the video, because, you know, for example, the Skeet and Shiraz fight, you know, if for some, you know, strange reason, the referee actually managed to miss that, it would have been a quick video like, okay, yeah, Skeet was definitely down. He definitely took 2 to 3 blows, disqualification.
Yeah, and there have actually been instances, and I can't remember the specific fights, but there have been fights also in the recent past where officials have had the option of using video replay and didn't use it for controversial calls.
Sorry to interrupt, but the one that obviously that we know of, Maloney and Franco, in Las Vegas during COVID was when they used it and it took a very long time and they still got it wrong.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's, you would think that there's so many egos and so much riding on things in boxing like that, especially in bigger fights, that it's like, I'm almost not surprised that an official wouldn't be able to just like, damn, I fucked that call up in real time. We need to go back and edit, you know, we need to do that, or we need to start the round, whatever it is. And you would almost think like, it's right there on video. Why can't you do that? But it doesn't surprise me that would happen. It's just dumb, you know, and it should be in a slightly more dependable sport or a slightly more mainstream sport, you would be able to depend on the fact that there would be a commission or something punishing that referee who screwed that call up and just saw it on video that he screwed it up and did it anyway, he wouldn't be officiating for the next 6 months, but in boxing, he's going to be back in next week.
Do you think something like punishing them, maybe it's just too strong a word, but, you know, dropping somebody that's had a bad performance to, you know, undercard fights until they kind of improve their performance and then coming back up, or, you know, doing that to, say, like a bigger name referee, do they think of that as too much of a punishment, and, you know, the fans will notice and that's why they don't do it?
They actually have done that in a few cases. Like, for instance, after Abner Mares beat Joseph Agbeko, and I want to say 2011-ish, the first time, in the first fight, Russell Mora was the referee, and he missed like umpteen low blows. And then finally Abner Mares hits him with a low blow that's just like lethal, to the point where it's like hitting his like leg almost. And Agbeko goes down, and then he starts counting them. Like, and Agbeko's like, "What? You're counting?" And he totally screws it up to the point where it like affects the fight, and Mares wins the fight in a really close, controversial. And anyway, Russell Mora wound up being yanked from officiating cards, and wound up having to go to, like, you know, continuing education with, I think it was Jane Haney and Joe Cortez, which itself is its own issue. For Christ's sake, why would you send anybody to them? But regardless, you know, they have done things like that, but it seems to be just in really extreme cases.
It's one that we could beat for a long time, that kind of discussion.
Well, it's rare enough that I can remember the extreme cases in any way, you know, right. So from 10 years ago.
Yeah. You know, I think, you know, hopefully I think this, and obviously, you know, money's aside, they should get like a team, like, you know, breed them through, because there's so much money going in and around the sport. I know, obviously, you know, boxing, a lot of the money just goes to the big fighters, goes to Tyson Fury, Floyd Mayweather's and those guys. And it doesn't stay, you know, lower down. But they need to do something, because it seems like pretty much every weekend we have some kind of talking point, and it really does affect the fighters that lose, because their paychecks significantly drop, and, you know, they may never get a TV fight again. You know, they may never get a world title shot again. It's only the big boys that earn that sort of life-changing money.
So we need to get a hold of like Eddie Hearn or one of these wealthy cats that's crazy enough to genetically engineer and raise officials. That's all they do all their life, is just they're raised from a young age to be a boxing official. No, I don't know. It's a complex issue, you know, and it kind of sucks, but it does seem like something that needs to be addressed here.
It does, because you hear it, you'll hear the uproar for a day or two, and then everyone just focuses on the fights the next week, and everyone seems to have forgotten about it. But I'm sure the people that, you know, the fighters that are on the losing end of these bad decisions, they've not forgotten about it. You know, it's going to take them, you know, exactly, weeks, months, or they may never come back, because they may never get another chance on TV on these big 100%. Cards. But unless it happens in, you know, a huge fight like Tyson Fury, Deontay Wilder 1, even the scorecards for that first fight were atrocious, and that was soon out of our minds.
Yeah, no question, you know, and that they were able to top those. But yeah, it's a problem. And a lot of those judges, I mean, we've seen it this year, judges who have turned in really bad cards and then they're judging again a couple of weeks later. It's bad.
Yeah. And kind of fitting, moving on to our next fight, which has some atrocious scorecards. Saturday, the 18th of December, from the Manchester Arena, Manchester in the UK, on DAZN. Joseph Parker moves to 30-2 with a unanimous decision 12 over Jerick Chisora, who dropped to 32-12. Chisora was down three times over many rounds, and they still came back with scorecards of 114-112, 115-111, and 115-110. What did you think of Parker and Chisora's performances?
I think that it was one of those kinds of fights where it was obviously very exciting. It definitely wasn't quite on the level of a Fury Wilder 3, but it was a lot of fun. And it kind of, in my opinion, and I don't want to just speak negatively about it, but it did kind of showcase a couple of bad things about both guys, in my opinion. One was that Joseph Parker, he just has like one gear. He doesn't really seem to get out of one, maybe two gears. He needs to be able to have a greater sense of urgency, but not, it's almost like he can't, as soon as he realizes the guy's going to punch him back, he's like, whoa, hold on now there, buddy. And so it's like stops, even though the guy's like teetering about in awful condition. And Derek Chisora has just, despite being Warrior, taken so much punishment over the course of his career. He doesn't sound bad that I can tell, but he just, his legs look awful. Like, he gets hit and he just stiffens up. Like, he's just, it was kind of like Unieski Gonzalez and, you know, against Zurdo Ramirez. It's just like he gets hit and it's like, you know, his legs don't go anywhere and he's not moving his head and he's just kind of sitting there. And it's scary to watch, especially with a heavyweight who can, Joseph Parker's not a big puncher, but that almost makes it worse. So, you know, it was kind of tough to watch Chisora get beaten on like that. But then the judges turn in scorecards where it's like, you know, he could have won that fight. No.
You take away a couple of the knockdowns and he had Chisora winning like six rounds somehow.
Yeah, that's no good.
Yeah, I totally agree. I thought, you know, watching the first fight, you know, Parker's performance in this fight was better. Andy Lee had said in interviews beforehand that he kind of agreed with exactly what you said, you know, that Parker only had one gear, was kind of like gun shy. Only kind of, he kept, in an interview I watched, he was kind of very revealing that he said that Parker would kind of throw and maybe get tired and would then do little things to kind of take a break, like go for a little walk, do something to the crowd sort of thing to take a little break. And he, you know, in training for that fight, he told him like, no, like carry on throwing, like throw at the heavy bag for like 3 minutes, no break. There's no stopping. There's no, you know, going for a little walk and doing this and doing that.
Yeah.
So I thought he was very honest, a good review, you know, what he needed to change.
Yeah.
Yeah. I thought it was a little bit better, but yeah, he's still kind of gun shy, isn't he? Cause he had Chisora a few times against the ropes and yeah, he was very worried about what was coming back because, you know, Chisora was kind of clever, would walk him to the corner, wouldn't he, after he kept getting knocked down?
Yeah.
And he was just kind of like going into the shell, just looking for that kind of like one hit a quitter, hoping that he could kind of catch Parker coming in. But yeah, I do worry for Chisora. Like you said, I watched the interview on Sunday with Coogan Cassius and they were at some Russian spa or something like that. And yeah, he still talks very well. I kind of like his attitude about like, he knows he's not going to win a world title, but he's kind of like the Nate Diaz of the boxing world, where he just wants to fight everybody. He's just a warrior. He wants to fight Deontay Wilder next. And, you know, we complain about people not wanting to fight. So, you know what? If he's talking okay, he wants to carry on fighting, then, you know, all credit to him, because we always complain about Billy Joe Saunders and Caleb Plant, like we just touched on, had no, you know, defining victories or no defining fights as such, and they were both world champions. But Chisora's like, yeah, I'll fight anybody. I'm a gladiator. I fight for money and legacy. You pay me enough money, I'll fight anyone. So you have to kind of give him credit for that, really, because he's fought a who's who. He's fought, when you look at it, Klitschko, David Haye, Tyson Fury, Joseph Parker, Pulev. So, yeah, he's definitely a one I think that, you know, fighters should look at and say, you know what, like, I can earn good money and have, you know, a pretty good boxing career. But they're too scared to have that 32 and 12, that 12 on the right-hand side of the ledger, they're scared of. They're scared of it, you know, from changing, being an O.
Totally. Yeah. And I mean, I mean this in a good way. It might not come out how I quite want it, but in the U.S. we have a saying where we say the world needs ditch diggers too. And it's just like in boxing, you know, we need journeymen. We need those kind of like gatekeeper battlers. We need those kinds of fighters who are down to just fight whomever, wherever, whenever. And we need also, I mean, that's what makes boxing and other combat sports fun. The contrast of styles, the contrast of attitudes and characters and personalities, and the fact that it is a mishmash of all of these things. And Derek Chisora, he fits in, you know, he fits in really well as either a fan favorite or a guy that fans like to see get his ass kicked because of the way that he talks or whatever, or, you know, he's too cocky or I don't know. It doesn't seem like that to me, but I could see, I guess, how some people could view him that way. To me, I see him as just he's a road warrior. That's who he is. He's a guy who's coming in not just to get a paycheck, but he's coming in to test you a little bit. And you got to respect that. Against Joseph Parker, I do think that Joseph Parker clearly showed that he's on a different level, but you just would have liked to see you know, a more definitive answer from him.
I love this, the subject of journeyman. It's you don't really get the same type of journeyman in the US that you do in the UK, you know, because in the UK, you'll see people with 7 wins, 297 losses. Yeah. You don't see that in the US. And I'm probably going to get sidetracked now because I kind of love this subject.
It's fun. Well, and I've mentioned this before, and I say it somewhat regularly because it's like it's one of those reminders that fans need, like, constantly. But the boxing that we talk about, the boxing the vast majority of people talk about, is like 1% of the sport, if that. The vast majority of the sport is journeymen and, you know, crappy fighters who are fighting for $500 a pop and aren't expected to win. You know, that's the vast majority of the sport are fighters like that. And the all of these prestigious whatevers are a really tiny slice of the sport. And that's what people seem to forget, is this is an international sport and there's so many participants that not everybody can be good or world class. So there are a lot of journeymen, and they're a lot, they seem to be a lot more accepted, or I don't know, I don't want to say tolerated, because it's almost like they're revered, I guess, a little bit more in the UK, but also the boxing scene's healthier there overall.
You think so?
I would say so. I mean, it could, if you take it as like, you know, a per capita type of thing, I think that more people in the UK are aware of what's going on boxing wise than in the US. Obviously there's more people and I get that, but like per capita, I think that just there's more awareness in the UK of boxing.
Is it down to not getting a license as a journeyman? Like when you get to say 40 losses, is it just the states won't license you? Or is it like you touched on, it's not revered, where people kind of get stick and they just give up? Is that what you think? Or?
That's a good question. I think that there's a possibility that there's not that much money in it too. So that's a fair, you know, assessment also, but there has been criticism of the British Boxing Board of Control too. So there has been criticism of the BBOC because of those kinds of things. Mm. And because of like, you know, controversial licensing of fighters and handling of events and stuff like that. But that's, we get the same, I guess, in the US for whatever alphabet organizations. But in any case, I don't know. I guess there's just a stronger amateur scene. There's a stronger local scene for boxing. Whereas in the US, a lot of cities that used to be boxing cities just aren't anymore. And if you want to go to see boxing, like you're going to have to go to one of like only a handful of places if it's going to be like world-class boxing, you know? So I think that that's kind of a problem, like from top to bottom in the US, the whole thing has been kind of disintegrated a bit. And in the UK, comparatively, it's a bit more healthy.
That's a whole podcast on itself, I think, talking about journeyman. Totally. I love that subject. Anyway, moving on, Lerone Richards moved to 16-0 with a split decision over Carlos Gongora, who dropped to 20-1. This was for the IBO super middleweight. Going into this card, I thought this could be, you know, like a sneakily the best fight matchup on the card. Overall, I thought it was a good performance from Lerone Richards, and I think the right person won on the scorecards in the end.
Yeah, and you know, Carlos Gongora being Ecuadorian, you know, had a good story behind him, and also I think that there were a lot of people who were looking toward him as a potential future of, you know, the super middleweight division, or somebody who could be at some point. And so I think that, yeah, there was a lot of hype, or hardcore hype, I would say, among the hardcore fans going into that fight, hoping that it would be a little bit better than it was. It was a competitive fight. It just wasn't super action packed in the way that some people might thought it'd be. thought it might be a little bit more explosive than it wound up being. So yeah, but otherwise I thought Lerone Richards actually did look pretty good and looks like super middleweight's, you know, very healthy overall. It's kind of bustled into a fun division. And so to see Richards kind of join you know, not the top of the division, but, you know, move toward the top division is very interesting.
Skillful, but not heavy-handed, you know, in Lerone. I think that would be
right
more for people like ourselves, you know, boxing purists, you know, someone who likes that kind of style. More for your casual fans who just come in really for the gladiatorial knockouts. I don't know if they'll find Richards, you know, pleasing.
Yeah, and I think that Gongora, generally speaking, has a better style for like the casual fans, and a better story. But yeah. But even so, you know, Richards got the win. And so I don't know. I mean, I'd like to see where he goes from here anyway.
Yeah, and I do feel for Gongora, because I think Eddie Hearn was saying that he only turned up like a day or two before because he had visa issues and he had to fly in really, really late. And, you know, when he's holding kind of a world title, do you class IBO as a world title? You know, back in the day it was.
Some people consider it a world title. I don't really care that much. You know, I mean, I guess it's more just some kind of thinking of like how the division is ranked or organized, you know, in my head. Because it's, unless somebody's like undisputed or clearly a number one, then I don't really care too much. And clearly Canelo's the number one. So anything beyond that is just academic. But yeah, I actually did see also after the fight that Gongora seemed to have a real good attitude about it. And was just kind of like, well, shit, you know, what do you want me to do? We'll just have to get him next time. Got to respect that, you know, because there was a lot going against him.
Yeah, I'm sure Lerone Richards will run for the hills. He won't want a rematch of that, you know.
I wouldn't imagine so. No,
Gongora is one of those kind of, you know, high risk, low reward type of fighters.
Exactly.
So
exactly.
Stay clear of those.
Yeah. Well, and I also say like this is just kind of a thing that I say that it's half funny, half true. Stay if you're like a prospect or whatever. Stay away from those unknown or semi-unknown South American and Central American dudes who have a high KO percentage. Stay away from them.
I think COVID.
Don't go near them.
Yeah, COVID's proven that. Ever since Eddie Hearn kind of linked up with Canelo's promotions, and he was bringing them over, and they were just knocking out all the English guys.
Yeah, dude, stay away from them. Just don't take that risk. Work up to it. Don't, you know, they're dangerous. So yeah, Gongora, I probably wouldn't want to tangle with him again if I didn't have to, if I'm Richards.
No, kind of going into this fight, Kevin Sadjo was 17-0 with a TKO 6 over Jack Cullen. This was for the vacant European super middleweight title. Talking of KOs, what a body shot.
Oh man. There was so much going on this weekend that, like, you know, it was tough to pick out highlights, right? Like combat sports wise this past weekend, it was just like a cornucopia. And usually it's funny because toward the end of the year, it gets a little slow. Sometimes it's like, oh, okay, we got one card next weekend. Great. And that's all we're looking forward to. But like this, you know, the flourishing of all of the streaming apps and all this type of stuff is just given more platforms to fighters, which is great. And they've tried to cram in, I think, all of the contractual, mandatory contractual, whatever minimums for these fighters at the end of the year. But anyway, yeah, picking out the highlights was tough. And so seeing that body shot knockout was just like, finally something to kind of push toward the top of the pack for a kind of highlight of the weekend, you know, but it was great.
Yeah, you really can't beat a good body shot. The way it just folds people. And they kind of looking to try to get up, but they just can't get the breath.
Yeah, and you know, I think that I hadn't really heard too much about Sadjo. Like, I'd read about him, but I don't even think I'd seen him before, to be honest. So to get it was a nice introduction.
Yeah, because he was a last-minute opponent as well after the original opponent dropped out. So he took it on late notice, and what better than folding somebody with a body shot live on DAZN?
Well, man, I know Eddie Hearn couldn't be happier.
Right. right, moving on to, is this real boxing? Amelia Arena, Tampa, Florida on Showtime pay-per-view. Jake Paul moved to 5-0 with a KO of 6 over Tyrone Woodley. Firstly, do you like these type of fights?
They don't bother me. Like, they're not my thing per se, but they don't bother me like they seem to. A lot of boxing fans.
Yeah, I mean, to me, if they matched well, it's the equivalent of kind of like white collar boxing in the UK. Like we have white collar fights. It's like, it's not amateur. It's not professional. It's just kind of like me and you decide to fight. So we go and have like a mini camp for 8 to 12 weeks. And then we just fight. We sell tickets to our friends. It's in like a local like sports hall or something like that. It's just similar to that, just on a huge scale.
I think the main criticism, as we know, it's like the people think that they're ruining the sanctity of boxing. It's not real boxing, or, you know, more specifically, I think what you'll probably see more than anything is Jake Paul's not fighting real boxers. He's not a real boxer. He's not fighting real boxers. He's fighting mixed martial artists. Or he's fighting, you know, a YouTuber.
He's not a boxer.
Well, I don't know. You know, none of these people are really boxers, I guess. And so, I mean, it's, I guess, just how serious you want to take it is that's what it comes down to. How serious are you getting about this? And so there are kind of bad things, I guess. Yeah, somebody could get hurt, as with any combat sport. Somebody could get hurt, and that would be a pretty shitty look. But another bad thing is that obviously often they're kind of like crappy from an entertainment standpoint. I've seen them all at this point now, and a couple of them have been pretty shitty and, you know, mostly like, wow, there are these two tired ass people who are not used to being in the ring and being tired like this, draping all over each other. I've seen tough man contests, and what happens when people who aren't full-time fighters all of the time on a world-class level get in there after like three rounds, they're tired as shit. That's just what happens, and they suck. So, I mean, like, there's a number of bad things about this, really, but there's nothing that these kinds of fights and events are doing to boxing or to combat sports that boxing isn't doing to boxing. There's nothing that these events are doing that is any worse than what boxing is doing, which in and of itself is an argument that they should happen. It's just, in my opinion, points to it clearly being absurd that it's ruining anything. It's not ruining anything. It's just, how serious are you taking it? Don't take it that serious. I don't know. But then one of the extremely good things about it is seeing somebody like Amanda Serrano on the undercard and getting paid really well when other promoters have flat out said, I'm not paying you that. Mm-hmm. And obviously Jake Paul and, you know, the money he generates makes it so that the means are there to pay her that. But even so, well, that's not Jake Paul's problem to make, you know, to figure out how these other promoters need to treat their fighters. And so he's in effect raising awareness about those kinds of things. And a lot of fans have said, wait a second, you know, so if he's turning around and doing this, it's creating cognitive dissonance for some fans, despite the fact they really want to hate him. So it's a complicated situation in that regard. But the fights themselves are just, you know, apart from the actual boxing fights, the main events, like Jake Paul's just, he's an attraction. Boxing's had them since the beginning.
I'm just glad to see that we haven't heard rumors of or seen on this card your Evander Holyfields, your Mike Tysons, your Roy Joneses, you know, coming back and fighting again. And hopefully after, you know, Holyfield's last performance, it's kind of taken a bit of a back burn, you know, that they've, you're going to stop doing those until, I thought it was going to be until somebody got seriously hurt.
Well, and I don't think we were that far from that there. So thankfully that didn't wind up happening. But I think that it was like, there were a group of people who were still able to sell this. They were able to, I guess, cleverly edit videos of Holyfield training, I guess. Because he looked awful the whole time. Every single video I saw that wasn't edited, I was like, oh, good God, please, like, you know, somebody step in and don't let this happen. But I don't know if people were truly convinced or if they were just had that much money riding on it that they didn't care. Probably a little of all of these things. But when it finally happened and they see how bad he looks, it's like, it was almost, I think, a little bit of a shock. Like, oh, shit, like, we can't do this. Like, this is not. You know, there's too much of a risk of anybody remotely like eroded, getting really messed up. And obviously that risk is there enough for regular boxing. So I think that it was a little bit of a scare with that. And so it seems like, for instance, Triller is now leaning a little bit harder into their actual boxing fight club and their triad combat thing that they're doing. Right. So
I think I'm right in saying you follow MMA, right, Patrick?
I do. I follow bare knuckle and MMA, yeah.
So the two names that seem to be popping up for Jake Paul's next opponent, Anderson Silva, Masvidal, both have a bit of boxing and, you know, bare knuckle background. How do you think he would do against either of those?
Anderson Silva is actually pretty good with his hands. And
beat Chavez.
And beat him pretty good. It's tough to say what that's saying at this point. But, I mean, he's always been good with his hands. It must have been probably like 2008 or something like that, him talking about challenging Roy Jones. Mm. Maybe 2009, maybe a little later. But in any case, it was a while back. He's always had very good striking, and he's always been good with his hands. So I wouldn't put it past somebody like Anderson Silva, who seems to speak very well and pretty much have it together. I wouldn't put it past him to defeat somebody like that. George Masvidal, I think he's probably a little bit too small. He's also was saying on Twitter that he's contractually tied to UFC, and UFC is not going to go for something like that unless like the pot is so big that he's breaking them off and it makes sense. And that's the problem with UFC, that corporate structure, is that they're taking so much off of the top of fighters that Jake Paul's whole, like I was saying, his whole kind of mantra on this thing is that it's like he's promoting himself, like nobody's taking his money. And so that, I think, is not an attractive option for him. In the ring, though, I think Masvidal, there's a pretty good chance that he'd probably get his clock clean, because, like I said, he's kind of small. And he's good with his hands, but good with your hands in MMA and boxing are two very different things.
Different stance.
Yeah, just different things, you know. And we've already seen him get tipped up pretty good with his hands by people who weren't, full-time. And say what you will about Jake Paul, I'm not saying he's a real boxer, but he does have the money and the dedication to be training in boxing full-time. And that makes a pretty big difference. So anyway, not to defend Jake Paul too much, but I think he might hurt him.
Yeah, I mean, he does the basics just well. Just keeps it very simple with the 1-2, doesn't he? BJ Forrest has kind of drilled that into him. And he seems to be, so far, I thought he was going to come unstuck when he fought Woodley the first time, just due to the fact that Woodley was a professional fighter. And how wrong was I?
Well, and I thought that there was a pretty good chance, too. It was just, I guess, his saving grace was that Tyron Woodley's he's never been a great striker. He's always been more of a grappler and kind of like mauling guy. So, but I thought, he was at least a full-time fighter in the very recent past, and that might spell trouble. And it did almost in the first fight. Mm. But you're right. He's gotten the basics down enough so that he can really execute fairly simple plans against. I just basically think if you put a real fighter in there, a real cruiserweight, even light heavyweight, it's not going to take too much to just beat the ever loving crap out of him. Nothing against him. It's just what you pick up in a half of a lifetime of boxing is always going to be better than what you pick up in a few years of dedicated boxing, period, on the world-class level. So you put anybody competent in against him and it's going to be bad news for Jake Paul.
And we may as well touch on it since everyone was posting it. Was it a fix? Did that little hand twist, was that his signature for Tyrone to drop your hands and get knocked out?
That always seems, when people are claiming, when a guy's clearly unconscious and they're like, that's a fix. That seems like that's the stupidest way for a fight to be fixed, man. Because it seems like if you are going to fix it, you could fix it in a way where one guy doesn't get knocked unconscious and potentially damaged permanently. But whatever, what do I know? But no, man, I don't think that was a freaking fix. That seems like a real dumb way to fix a fight, personally. There are a lot better ways to do it than that.
you already touched on it. It was on that card. Amanda Serrano moved to 42-1-1 with a unanimous decision 10 over Miriam Gutierrez. Bit of a beatdown, really, for Gutierrez, and it's good to see. Hopefully, I'll believe it when it's announced that we'll finally see Amanda Serrano fight Katie Taylor.
I hope so, because Amanda Serrano is, you know, she's competed in, I want to say she's competed in Gi, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. She's competed in MMA now, and she's like, what, she's 3-0-1 or something like that. Or,
yeah, she posted it today, didn't she, on Twitter?
You know, yeah, something. I'm pretty sure she's unbeaten, and she's only got one loss in boxing, holds multiple titles across divisions, et cetera, et cetera. She's clearly hit a groove and is easily, if not the best women's boxer today. She's one of them, but one of the few, clearly. So, yeah, Katie Taylor, I think, is also a fighter who's like, a lot of people were waiting to fail, and she almost has a few times. There have been a couple of decisions where it seemed like maybe she possibly didn't deserve them, but she also has improved. She's gotten better, and almost to the point where people weren't expecting that she'd get better, and she did. So is she good enough to beat Amanda Serrano? I'm not sure. Amanda Serrano actually also took a few punches herself, but it was also, I think, a situation where she was like just really opening up, and so therefore was open herself. So I do kind of worry about that a little bit, but she's in a groove. So I'd love to see that fight. And I think that you kind of got to lean towards Serrano at this point.
I think, I know I was going to go Katie Taylor, just stick with the British pride, but in the last couple of fights, I just do think Katie Taylor has slowed a little bit. And I don't know whether it's because maybe the opposition wasn't of the best standard and maybe she took a foot off the gas. But when she's going in with somebody like Serrano, like you said, all the accolades, the 42-1-1, pretty much everybody's going to say like, hey, this is the biggest women's fight of all time. That probably brings the training and to a different level, right? So hopefully we'll see Katie Taylor that moves a little bit more, because I thought she looked... Her feet were a little bit slow and she stayed in the pocket a lot more. Like she was just kind of like planting her feet and let's just slug it out. Like when she fought Delphine Persoon the first time, she kind of went down to Persoon's style of fighting, which didn't work. And then the second time when she fought Persoon, she boxed a little bit more and Persoon was kind of lost.
Yeah, she seems to be able to kind of like get drawn, fairly easily drawn into like a war, a slugfest, even when there are instances where like it seems like she doesn't need to, like the opponent that she's in with, like she could just outbox him, but she goes after him instead or kind of trades with him and opens herself up. And on top of that, being fair skinned, it's like, you know, she turns red quickly, she gets cut, you know, or gets bruised up and bumped, and you just look like hell when you wind up getting hit. So it looks bad. You know, she's been marked up pretty good after a few fights. So, yeah, and I agree also in her last handful of fights, she's been a little bit more stationary, a little bit more apt to staying in there in the pocket and kind of trading. And also, it sounds like that's not really what her corner wants her to do. So it does kind of raise some questions, like, is she stuck? You know, she can't get away from that style or what? I don't know. But it does seem like Amanda Serrano, at least just from, you know, that from the outset here, is it seems like she's would be a little bit too much skill wise for Katie Taylor. But we'd have to see. It's a big fight. Yeah. It's a real big fight.
I mean, hopefully 2022 for women's boxing, we get that. Clarissa Shields and Savannah Marshall. It's what women's boxing needs.
Yeah, I would agree. Because the big knock on women's boxing, despite the fact that it's really ramped up in the last few years, and it has, the knock on it is that the competition is not very good, which is not anybody, any one person's fault. Of course, that's a much bigger issue, but at the very least, making the fights that are available, the bigger fights that are available, the meaningful fights that are available, that's important. And doing those kinds of things, those kinds of fights, you know, that will, I think, send a message to fans that these fights can be big, they can be good, and that also sending a message to fans and pundits and whomever that promoters and other people who are in power in boxing are interested in these fights and willing to invest in these fights. And that's also sending a message to women, to the women fighters, that like, we're here, we care, we want to watch, and we're willing to spend money on it. So I think those things are important, especially in 2022.
I think you need to make it more lucrative to go into boxing than MMA? Because I think if you're a female fighter at the minute or over the last few years, you've got Ronda Rousey, Miesha Tate, Amanda Nunes, Pena now. You know, they're, you know, stars. Whereas in women's boxing, you didn't really have anyone.
That's true. That is very true. It's kind of gone through a couple cycles, women's boxing, where in the 90s it got very popular for a few years. I mean, it's starting long before that, but just recently. And then in the 2000s, like Million Dollar Baby came out and it got like kind of popular for a couple years. Leila Ali also, et cetera. And then it just kind of died down and it didn't really hear much about it. But then I think also with the resurgence in the Olympics, women participating in boxing in the Olympics, obviously that's a big part of the reason why Katie Taylor has been able to become so popular. Natasha Jonas, a number of British stars who have come from the Olympics or from the amateur scene in the UK. That was what I was talking about earlier with just generally speaking, the amateur scene in the UK being far healthier. You know, those things are really popular and I think are going to, those people are popular and are going to make a difference in how this is approached, I think. So it really, it's tough to navigate, but yeah, this is like the iron's hot. Now is the time. Now is the time really to make these fights, these good, interesting fights and show them what's up.
Yeah, no, exactly. 12 threes as well, more knockouts.
I totally agree. I 100% agree. And I think that just about every woman fighter agrees too. So let's do that.
Right. Moving on. It seems to be never ending fight reviews from the Armory in the Minneapolis, Minnesota on Fox. David Morrell, 6-0, TKO 4 over Atlantis Fox, 28-3-1. This was for the WBA super middleweight title. I'm a big fan of Morrell. I think he looks the part. He looks strong. He looks skillful. He's still learning slightly, you know. But at 6-0 to hold a version of the WBA's, you know, super middleweight title, I think slowly but surely, I think he's gonna come through.
Yeah, you know, a fight between two guys who are, you know, well, I wouldn't necessarily call it a crossroads because Morrell only has a handful of fights. Mm. But even so, I mean, like every fight when you're kind of pushing far up the ladder with every fight and you only have a handful of fights, you know, it's every fight is like a crossroads fight. But Morrell, yeah, he does look the part. Alantes Fox, while not having the greatest record, was clearly not in the same league. And being able to, it's kind of like I was saying before with Canelo, not necessarily comparing Morrell and Canelo, but just dealing with opponents appropriately. You know, if you are struggling with somebody who is in there to challenge you, but you really should be getting by, that's a problem. Whereas Morrell, he was put in there with a guy who was supposed to test him, and it wasn't that much of a test. It was a test that he passed very readily. So, yeah, he definitely looks good. And super middleweight, again, is just chock full, or at least getting fuller, not really paying too close attention to the titles and whatnot, but they're up there. They're this kind of 5 to 10 spot, you know, top 5 to top 10 spots in super middleweight's interesting for sure.
Do you think he's one of those ones that's, he hasn't got that big a name that everybody talks about him, but he could surprise a few and come through?
David Morrell?
Yeah, do you think he could surprise a few of the bigger names and actually, you know, in a few years from now, he's the guy we're talking about?
Well, he's pretty young. And I think that that's something you also don't see from a ton of Cubans, a ton of Cuban fighters, is they often wind up having to get to the U.S. and ply their trade in the U.S. when they're like, you know, in their late 20s, early 30s, if not later. So having a fighter, you know, of that caliber at a fairly younger age, number one, is that's good. But also coming up that quickly, he's got good stature. He's like 6'2" or something like that. You know, he's got a good size. Yeah, he's the kind of fighter that they want to keep their eye on and potentially stay away from if they could help it.
And he doesn't have that, dare I say, boring Cuban style.
Well, and that's often the knock on Cuban fighters or the perception. And so I guess that could be something working against him. But if he keeps stopping, if he keeps running through opponents, then there's not going to be anything anyone can do.
Right. Next card, AT&T Center, San Antonio, Texas on DAZN. Gilberto Ramirez moved to 43-0 with a TKO 10 over Unescus. Is that right? Gonzalez, 21-4. Really a run-of-the-mill fight for Ramirez. I didn't think Gonzalez was looked that great. And obviously this was really for the winner faces Bivol for the WBA light heavyweight title championship. So what do you think of Ramirez? He's come back after quite a long layoff, obviously now with Golden Boy, had his falling outs with Top Rank due to some management things. Do you think he's the Ramirez we saw before?
I'm not really sure, because he is the kind of fighter who doesn't really do almost anything spectacularly. Mm. Like, he's just kind of an honest fighter, you know. He's, well, in terms of physical attributes, there's nothing spectacular about him. He's not super fast, doesn't hit that hard, his legs aren't that fast, you know, doesn't really move his head, doesn't have great defense. He's just tough and does not stop. Mm. And you know, those kinds of attributes can win world titles and can get fighters very far, but the management and promotional issues have really prevented him from being navigated the way that he would. But also, I think that there's some reservations there because of his style and because of the fact that he's not a big hitter and stuff. So it does seem to me that sometimes that the willingness of the Mexican fan base to support him is being, I don't want to say exploited, but it's being played up for sure. Like, they're, instead of putting him in with a much better fighter quicker, they're kind of milking the paydays while they can. That's kind of the feeling you get. And even so, Unescu Gonzalez was not really supposed to be in there as, I mean, I brought this up earlier, but like, he got hit and he just stiffened up. Like, he wasn't moving whatsoever at all. And he got hit hurt like a dozen times during the fight, where he was just like frozen in time, just not moving. And it looks terrible and it's freaking scary, number one. But then, you know, Ramirez is having trouble putting him away and doing anything with the situation, and it wound up being a back and forth war when it didn't really seem like it should have been or needed to be. And it was a lot of fun, but these aren't necessarily things that you want to see from Zurdo Ramirez. You don't want to see him in a war with Unescu Gonzalez if you're his promoter, or if somebody supporting him or wanting him to move forward against better fighters. You don't want to see him go into war in this fight, but he did. So it's fun. It's good for the fans, but it's not a good indicator of him being top class, you know?
Do you think also at times fighting 43 journeymen, gatekeepers, gimmies will actually make him stale? Because when he's going to jump in next with a Bivol, he's going to be like, oh my God, this guy actually moves and hits back.
Well, and that's the other side of it, is how much good is it even doing? Mm. Because he's already kind of getting dinged around anyway. Mm. So you're just kind of stretching this out, you know? That's why I say it seems as like they're milking it, you know? It's like they could have gone after a Bivol or somebody else much sooner. And again, I know promotional managerial things, those can halt matters very quickly, but it just seems like they've been treading water for a bit. So yeah, I don't see him as in the mix nearly as much as some others might. He'll have to show something else, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I think he may be getting Bivol at the right time, because he didn't look too clever in his last fight when he fought Umar Salamov, and when he fought the British guy, was it Craig Richards? He looked beatable in both of those. But like we touched on earlier, is it just the fact that he's fighting these guys because he couldn't get anybody else? And when he gets in there with somebody like, you know, Zurdo Ramirez, is he going to turn it up? Now, was he playing possum like Usyk, like supposedly Usyk does, where he shows you what he wants you to see? So we come out with some crazy stuff, don't we, boxing fans?
And there's always the possibility, too, with those fighters who have had a long amateur career, that they just get old, even when they're not that old chronologically, but they're like 31, but they've had like 400 amateur fights, and like 20 pro fights, and they're just done. It happens. It wouldn't be the first time. So I'm not saying that's the case, but yeah, there's always that kind of possibility with the better Bievs, the Bivols, you know, those guys, who knows?
Yeah. I mean, I'll definitely give Ramirez a lot more credit if he gets in there with, you know, Bivol and does a number on Bivol, because I really agree with you. So far, he's fought 43-0, and I struggle to think of a signature win on that resume.
Well, you'd think that just about any other fighter that's, you know, undefeated at 40-something and 0, people would be like, oh, we got to start paying attention to this. But no, Nobody really is.
In a popular division, it's not like he's a minimum weight, you know, where people don't really pay attention to it.
Yeah, that's the crazy thing, is that he ticks a lot of boxes. It seems like he'd be popular, but he's not that popular.
Right, moving on to news and notes. Looks like we're going to get one of the big fights we've all kind of been waiting for. Errol Spence and Ugas are aligned to fight. And the PBC are in the process of finalizing this deal to take place in March or April on pay-per-view. What do you think of that, Patrick? Obviously, we've been wanting Errol Spence and Crawford. Errol Spence and Ugas is a good second. You know, maybe they can unify those titles, and then Crawford maybe in the summer.
Yeah, there are obviously, there's no question. We want Spence Crawford. That's the fight everybody wants. That's, you know, there's no asterisk on that one. But there are a lot of moving parts for big fights, period. But there's also a lot of things going on in this division and with the players. There was a question as to how healthy Errol Spence I was. I think it just recently got cleared for him. And he probably had already been, you know, training, but just not getting hit or something like that. Whereas Crawford just defeated Sean Porter. The timing might not have matched up quite right. I really have no idea. But also, I think that there's a case to be made for Yordanis Ugas, like, deserving this shot. Mm-hmm. You know, over Crawford, I'm not saying that, but he does deserve this kind of fight. You know, he earned it. Independently of whatever's going on with Crawford and Spence. And so does he get punished because, you know, and so there have been complaints about this fight being made and about the fact that it's on pay-per-view. Personally, I see it as a fight between two top welterweights, and I don't have any problem with it. The pay-per-view aspect of it is kind of tricky. Over the last handful of years, there has been a push and pull over what warrants pay-per-view and what doesn't. So I'm open to that discussion, but it's kind of one of those things where the proof is in the pudding, because if fans pay for it, they pay for it and they're willing to pay for it. So shut up. If they don't, that's the lesson that the promoters learn and the fighters learn. So that's, for me, the kind of thing where, you know, I don't like the pay-per-view aspect of it, but it's a fight between two top welterweights in a division that's kind of top heavy, but still pretty good. So, I think also from Errol Spence's perspective, strategically, right, going into a fight with Terrence Crawford, if he were to just make it now, Terrence Crawford could potentially say, you know, imaginarily, well, I just took out Sean Porter. You couldn't do that. You know, you struggled with him and he kicked your ass in a few rounds. Like, so I deserve the lion's share, or it's 50-50 or whatever, you know? And whereas if Errol Spence goes forward and kicks the crap out of Yordanis Ugas, which is what most people, I think, would expect, assuming Errol Spence is anything near 100%, then he has, you know, the ball's kind of back in his court, and he can go back and say, well, I just beat the guy who beat Manny Pacquiao, who you've been chasing for however many years. So what's what now? You know, and it's, I think strategically there's something to say for what Spence is doing too. And also that pay-per-view aspect of it. If this fight does sell well, he can turn around and say, well, I just sold well against Yordanis Ugas, so I deserve more than 50%, buddy. So there's a lot of a strategy to it in the making of the fight. The actual fight itself, I don't know. I think there's a lot of unknowns about Errol Spence and his physical health, to be totally frank. I know a lot of people don't like hearing that, but that's true. I think that there's a lot of stuff going on with him that have, we got to see him in the ring again to see what's up, if his eye's really that bad.
What do you think about all the pay-per-views we've had over the last sort of 6 months? And then, you know, the Gervonta Davis against Isaac Cruz pay-per-view supposedly doing as low as, you know, 50,000. How does that make any sense to put that on pay-per-view? They must have lost a fortune.
I don't have any insight into pay-per-view numbers. That number sounds pretty low to me, like possibly too low. but again, I don't have any insight, so I don't know. I would say as a fan, and especially during the pandemic, and as somebody who's like not rich or wealthy in any remotely, you know, I don't want to pay $75 or $60 or $85 or whatever it is once a month, twice a month for a pay-per-view. That's just not ideal in any situation. So I don't really like the fact that that's kind of become the standard price of pay-per-views. However, when you factor in inflation and blah, 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 it's actually pretty in line with pay-per-view prices. But I mean, there are pros and cons. The cons are obviously the prices and the fact that we're kind of having to watch something on pay-per-view is like, well, if I want to check this fighter out, but I won't have to pay extra for it because I'm already paying for DAZN and I'm already paying for ESPN and I'm already paying for Showtime. I'm already paying for this. And now you're asking for a pay-per-view also. Like, that's kind of like, damn, dude. And DAZN's going to start doing pay-per-views. Like, shit, this is getting to be excessive again. And I thought we were just shedding this like 2, 3, 4 years ago. So those things I don't like, but this is also an overall trend within the sport and not necessarily promoter or outfit specific. And I think one of the pros, like I was kind of hinting at earlier, was that this is a direct view of the fighter's popularity and pull in a way, you know, assuming all of the back end work has been put in with the promotion and marketing. This is like somebody saying, this is what you pull. This is what you're worth. This is the number of people willing to pay to watch you fight. And obviously there's going to be some fluctuation with streaming, like illegal streaming and stuff like that. But that being said, it's not ideal, but it's in a really weird spot right now where all of these platforms and apps and everything, it's almost like overload. So it's almost like they're trying to fill these slots and there are fighters to fill them, but it winds up being excessive at times. And so I can't defend all of the pay-per-views. And frankly, like I was just reading before we were getting on the show, Keith Thurman, I'm not buying the pay-per-view.
Right. How about is it New Year's Day, the Charles Martin and somebody else?
Yeah, the whole heavyweight.
Where they've openly said, like, this is pretty shit. This is half as shit as the normal one, so it's going to be half the price.
Well, and I mean, I guess there's something to that. I guess I'm a little bit more inclined to, not that I like shit, but I guess I'm more inclined to be, you know, amenable to buying it if you tell me what it is, rather than going, this is the fucking Super Bowl, you know, every Saturday. It can't be the Super Bowl every Saturday, bro. Not every fight is like that. But, right, you know, when it gets hyped like that, it's, you know. But, yeah, so that those kinds of shows, they have their place.
Yeah, it's just, I do wonder at times, maybe coming from the UK, you know, it used to be like £15, then it went up to £20, and then now, like, an AJ fight would be £25. Because I remember moving over here around the time Mayweather fought Pacquiao, and it came up on the TV, like, hey, Mayweather Pacquiao in full HD. I think it was like $99.99. And I was like, what the? Took a photo on my phone, sent it to all my buddies in my WhatsApp group. I was like, dude, they pay $100 for a boxing pay-per-view in the US. And, you know, it was astounding. That's like five, at the price of five of them in the UK.
Yeah, it's excessive. And I mean, most people can't quite write it off on their taxes for, you know, so it's a lot, dude. It's not cheap to be a boxing fan, you know?
No, I think that's why, like you touched on, you know, it pushes more people to the illegal streams, where I'm sure they've done the math. I'm sure they've done the numbers and they've worked out at like, okay, if we charge this, we'll get this. Whereas, you know, sometimes is it like maybe charge $50 and less people will do the illegal streams. And because they'll be like, you know what, I might as well pay the 50 because at least the stream's not going to go out. you know, halfway through the fight, but I'm sure they've done the numbers and worked out, you know, what part's the creaming part where they can get enough.
Exactly. Yeah, there's, they probably pay some statistician to, you know, do all this work on that type of stuff. But yeah, you know, it's tricky and I don't envy that job, but right. But that's also not really my, I'm as a fan, like, I don't care. Just give me the fights and don't overcharge me. And sometimes that's what happens.
Right. Anyway, Patrick, before we let you go, I just want to get your picks for Fighter of the Year to begin with.
Sure. Yeah. I think that it's pretty clearly between Canelo Alvarez and Oleksandr Usyk. And I went with Alvarez because, you know, it's close, but it swings to Canelo in terms of both quantity as well as quality, in my opinion, because had Usyk defeated the true heavyweight champion, had, you know, he defeated Tyson Fury, he'd be in business, but he didn't. And Canelo nearly cleaned out an entire division and unified it in about a year's time, plus a little more. So I got to give it to him.
Your fight of the year, if you can name one or two.
That's a good question. I think I'd probably go with Fury Wilder 3. It was just a lot of fun. And I think that there's just something about heavyweight boxing when it's like great, that's a little bit different, you know, like it just kicks it up a notch. I love the little guys too, but when heavyweights are great, it's just a little bit different. But let's see. Oh, well, I think the other fight would probably have to be Chocolatito versus Estrada too. That fight was definitely terrific and on a high level, pretty much start to finish almost. So yeah, I'd probably go with Fury Wilder 3 and then Chocolatito versus Estrada 2.
Trainer of the year?
You know, I saw a couple people mentioning Andy Lee, but I don't think I saw him on any of the actual ballots or anything like that. I'm not sure if I would necessarily go with him. He's got to be pretty up there.
He only trains a couple of prospects. Jason Quigley, he kind of helps out with Fury, and obviously Joseph Parker.
Yeah, I thought that he had taken some more active role in the Fury camp, but maybe not. Maybe not. I could be wrong about that. But in any case, I probably would pick him anyway. I had this drawn up here a moment ago. Sorry, let me grab it. Where did I go? Oh, I thought I had it. In any case, gosh, that's a good question. I mean, I'd really like to go with BOMAC. If he, if Crawford would have been slightly more active, I probably think that would be a lock, but BOMAC's got to be up there.
Mm. He's building a very good stable over there.
Yeah, they've definitely got a really good crop of young, mostly young fighters that are coming up in a place that I guess you wouldn't generally expect. I'm not sure that necessarily makes him trainer of the year, but he's got to be up there.
Do you know, is BOMAC actually training Amir Khan, or is he just out there like training and sparring? And I know he's been on Instagram like over there for several weeks, and he has changed trainer several times. Be interesting to see who's in his corner for the Kell Brook fight.
Yeah, I don't know. That's a good question, because BOMAC has kind of gotten to the point now where like he's not famous per se, but not famous enough that, you know, other big name fighters would want to work with him. Mm. So I don't know. That's a good question. But, you know, I think maybe if I probably had to ride like a certain trainer, be Eddie Reynoso, because Canelo had a hell of a year. You know, I guess it would feel right to pick Canelo as the fighter of the year and Reynoso as the trainer of the year. And also, you know, he was with Ryan Garcia, who had a pretty good year. Not, you know, could have had a much more active year. It would have been nice, but regardless, yeah, Reynoso's got to be up there too then.
Yeah, I love Julio Cesar Martinez.
Yeah, totally.
That little crazy guy, like he's great to watch. And he's trained by Eddie.
That's a pretty good twosome there, BOMAC and Reynoso. Not bad.
KO of the year, if you can pick one or two.
Fury Wilder 3. I think that's for the same reason. I mean, it was a great fight. it was slightly one-sided apart from those kind of slivers, but man, those slivers were massive. Those those chunks were Wilder, you know, found his spots were huge. And so Fury triumphing like that, you know, with just a huge, like, basically put him to sleep type of KO. Not quite to sleep, but damn close to it. That's massive. I think I got to go with that.
And just kind of, it's different as well because it was unusual for Fury to finish a fight like that. You're so used to Fury dancing and moving and picking people apart and kind of making them look silly. And then just to now see him as this, like, come forward, walk you down, Terminator type of boxer.
Yeah. I think that it's kind of funny because I said this about Tyson Fury, like, not too long ago. There's so many things about him that I don't like, or that he said that I don't like, or things that I'm just like, oh God, dude, this guy. But there's also things that he does that I'm just like, oh man, I love this guy. You know, I don't want to, but kind of like Canelo, but for different reasons, he's also kind of won me over a little bit for, you know, especially in the ring where he seems like a pesky guy or an annoying fighter style wise. And he's been able to, in a handful of fights, turned around and fight in an entertaining way. And also show that he's got heart and that he's not just like, can't just box his way out of trouble, but he can fight his way out of trouble too. So that's, you know, that's exciting. And a lot of people like that.
Your prospect for next year for 2022.
You know, I think that it's probably got to be Xander Zayas. I know that's going to be the popular pick, but I mean, dude, you know, I think he fought either five or six times in 2021 and every single fighter had a winning record. Like that, like, never happens for a prospect, you know? I mean, and I'm not saying that having a winning record makes them good, but just generally speaking, prospects are fighting dudes that are like 2-91 or, you know, like something crazy. So you just don't really see it that often. And also he looks good. Eye test wise, he looks good. So I think he's got to be on there.
What's your opinion on one of the prospects I like coming out of the UK, Dennis McCann?
I'm not going to lie to you. I'm not familiar.
He's a Frank Warren fighter, another traveler or gypsy or whatever's the right
term. Did he fight recently?
Yeah.
Yes. Then
he's kind of got like blonde hair, kind of combed to the side. Okay. Kind of, yeah, everyone kind of says he has like a Nazim type of style.
I recognize the name now because I'm like, all right, that sounds familiar, but yeah, I'm not going to lie to you. I'm not super familiar with him. Now I'm going to go look it up.
Yeah. He's one to watch. Very good. I don't think he's been fighting kind of unbeaten dudes like Xander Zayas has. But yeah, slowly but surely, he seems to be, you know, very good, stylish. I think he'll be very fan-friendly. He interviews well, seems very down-to-earth, kind of surrounded by a lot of boxers. So yeah, I think he'll be one to watch. And then lastly, Patrick, before we let you go, three outlandish predictions for 2022.
Ooh, outlandish. Well, I don't know that it's necessarily that outlandish. It's probably fairly accurate. We're probably going to be seeing more fights in the United Arab Emirates, like in Dubai. I would say get used to, you know, when people were tripping out a couple of years ago or last year, whenever it was, that Anthony Joshua was rematching Andy Ruiz Jr. in Saudi Arabia. And people were like, what is this? Get used to that. Get used to these exotic locales for tax reasons and whatnot, people. I'm just saying. So get used to that in 2022. What else? Outlandish. Man, I don't know. They've already been beating the drum for Julio Cesar Chavez Jr. to get this Jake Paul fight. So I honestly would not be that surprised to see that actually happen, just because Julio Cesar Chavez Jr. is such like a goofball fan favorite type of thing where, like, you know, people can't stand him, but would rally behind him in a situation like that. So I think that could potentially happen. And outlandish. I don't know. You know, I think that we might see something. We might see Canelo toward the end of this year start talking about or doing something kind of weird, like, you know, talking about moving to heavyweight or talking about like unifying a cruiserweight or some shit like that. So I think those three are pretty decent outlandish. Yeah.
Especially if Usyk, you know, fights and defeats Joshua, he's more of a more of a regular sized opponent for like a Canelo that he could stand a small chance of. So yeah, I could see that. You know, if Joshua beats him or Tyson Fury beats him, Canelo fighting a 6'9" Anthony Joshua or Tyson Fury makes it slightly hard. Yeah.
And even so, Usyk's like not a small guy at all, but it does seem like, you know, just even in your mind's eye, he doesn't seem as big.
No, because he's like 6'3", 6'4", maybe something like that.
Yeah, he's a big guy. He's just not as filled out and broad as some of these other guys.
Yeah. Well, Patrick, you know, I enjoyed having you on again today. If you want to tell everybody about where they can find you and, you know, definitely tell them I was following and I think I retweeted for you guys. I really enjoyed the Boxing History and True Crime, the Ruben Ratman Bell podcast that you did recently.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah, I do a podcast with my buddy, generally Aris Pina, sometimes some other people as well, and do interviews and things like that. But it's called the Knuckles and Gloves podcast. And I'm generally on Twitter, probably more than any of the other social media apps. And on there, I'm Patrick M. Connor, Connor. But yeah, that's usually where I am. And yeah, so come talk, say hi, what's up, and I'm there.
And you can find us at The Last Round 12 on Instagram and Twitter. And unless we do a bonus show, I think you'll find us in the new year. We'll be doing the awards and predictions.
Thanks for supporting and listening to the show. Follow us at The Last Round 12 on social media. Rate, review, and subscribe. This is The Last Round 12.